not a fan of hybrid working. I think it creates like a classist system of the people who can come in and the people who can't. I'm very purist about this. We are a remote company. We get together every few months. We do not maintain an office. And so I kind of feel like you have to kind of go all or nothing one way or the other. And so that's, you know, that's why we've done it this way. And it is hard, but there's a snowball effect in having a core of people who really clearly like and trust each other. And it, I think it inspires that in other people.
That was Susan Cummings talking about how her view on remote work and trying to keep everybody in the same program.
Yeah, in the same room.
I thought that was pretty, that's the first time I've heard that. That sort of position, and it makes total sense. I remember like when we first started kind of coming out of COVID and we were like,
nobody wanted to go back.
I know, do whatever you want, like come in or start work from home, and everybody's work from home. So having a one way or another, that kind of makes sense. It's like, this is just how we're going to work and it's the same for everyone.
The classes thing is really true too. It's very like, it's like the kids that ride the bus on the way home versus the kids that get picked up. The kids on the bus have a completely, like, they have this, like, other, like, adventure, you know, that they can, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Well, and then there were the walkers, you know, there were some kids who lived close to school who would walk to and from. Yeah.
That's true. A group of friends.
Listener, just so you know, we had trouble picking the opening line because there were so many good ones. Can't wait to share this conversation with Susan with y'all. Susan's had a really interesting ride through this industry, and our paths have crossed many times in the path. She's awesome. So how are you, Aaron? We both just got back from GDC where we had a really good... But I'll speak for myself. What a great show. Had a lot of fun at the conference. Did a couple of sessions. Caught up with a lot of folks. A lot of business going on.
I saw one of them, or the tail end of one.
Yeah, I thought it was really, really energizing. How about you? How was your trip?
It was good.
By the way, how was that hotel you stayed at, listener? I don't know why. We stayed at different hotels on different sides of town.
That city needs Jesus and Batman.
Like, in what order?
It's like the Penguin took over. The Riddler and the Penguin are like, and Penguin are like, are, yeah, it was pretty crazy. Do you want me to elaborate?
No, I just wanted you to say, I just wanted you to say, I'm Batman.
I'm Batman. I'm Batman. Yeah, it's, that city is beautiful, first of all. Dirty, but very beautiful. And I've been in a lot of big cities before, Chicago, New York. Something's going on there. Anyways, other than that, the conference area was gorgeous. It was like a little overwhelming. And I was telling Jay this, that, and Kyle, like we were playing Fortnite. You know, we do our Fortnite hour. And we were talking about it. And I was a bit confused with... there's so many things there. Like, it's very like business. It's like a love letter to video games. Like, if you go to the GDC store, I don't know if you had a chance to walk in there. I went in there a few times.
The GDC store? I didn't get to go in.
Oh, I got a bunch of stuff. They had Jordan's book there. You can see Jordan's book on my counter. I found
that. Oh, look at that.
And then I got that book back there. See that little, that big Nintendo thing? It's called the...
Oh, yeah. It's like the game...
The game console 2.0. Beautiful book. I saw it. I picked it up. It's yellow. It's like, that's my favorite color.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, what is this? And it's just
An art book? I've never seen that book.
It's real consoles. It's like, it's just every page is a console from the past. And it's
really
ripped open. Yeah. And it's ripped open. So it's like, you know,
you see the insides and stuff?
Yeah. You see the hardware.
Oh, that's really so cool.
Yeah. And I bought that immediately. Anyways, but then you walk out of there and you go down to the showroom floor and there's like a big booth with like techno music. And it's like, we're a back-end services, you know, like, welcome to 2.0 of Code Deluxe for your, you know, and I'm like, dude, I don't know what you're talking about. You know what I mean?
Something you can do the VO, but you need a copywriter to go along with you there, buddy.
I don't know. I was making stuff up. If I said anybody that's real, I'm sorry. It's more, but you know what I mean? So it was like, when I went to the showroom floor, I could relate to like 5% of the stuff down there. a lot of business people or a lot of engineers or maybe like people that work with all that, because the games are big, you know? And then you walk out of there, and then I went to visit you a lot, and everyone in there is like a business person, you know? And they're like talking business. I'll give you $1 billion. No, $2 billion. Let's do it. You know, and like deal, like handshaking. And it was bustling in that hotel.
For those of you who may not know, this was Aaron's first trip to GDC. I was personally very excited for you to go to GDC.
Yeah, I want to go again. I have a plan now if I go next year. It was very chaotic. I saw some sessions. We recorded our special episode, like did some interviews there. Alex lost the recorder.
Oh my gosh. Hey, quick shout out to colleague, friend of mine over at ByteDance. We were having a meeting. I left that recorder in that meeting by accident.
And what did I tell you 5 minutes before? I like walked up to you.
So your parting words were, there's some really good stuff on here.
And I went to catch a flight. And then I'm on a plane and Alex is freaking out.
Well, and also thank you to Jay Pecco, our partner in crime, who went to go retrieve her for me because I was already on the plane home by the time it was rediscovered. So, hey, there's that's a nice story of the happy ending. Thank you, everyone, for joining us again this week. So excited to share with you our conversation with Susan Cummings. I hope you enjoy it. It's a good one.
It's very good, yes.
All right, welcome to the Fourth Curtain, friends. Today we are joined by a visionary, an executive, and an all-around awesome person, Susan Cummings. Susan is the CEO of Tiny Rebel Games. I think you're also, is Tiny Rebel and Petiverse two companies or one company and Petiverse is the product?
Petiverse is the product. Tiny Rebel Games is the company.
I've been looking at Petiverse, and I got to say, it sounds a lot more awesome than the Metaverse. So good on you for that. I'd like to hear more about how that all works. Susan, we met back in, it must have been the early aughts, I'm guessing, when you were at Rockstar and starting up 2K. Is it true? Did you sign both Borderlands and BioShock?
I did sign both, yeah.
Pretty good track record. Just a couple small little games right there. Susan, great to see you. How are you?
Good. I'm good. It's good to see you too.
So you're in the UK now, is that right? What's it like?
I am.
What's it like? Were you like in New York and then California and then the UK? Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I moved.
Your journey?
We left. I left Take-Two in early 2017. That we had January 2017, and I consulted to get out of my non-compete for a little bit. So my last day was Strauss Zelnick's first day, ironically enough. So I never met like the new regime. Ryan had left.
Wow.
Left.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that like, just coincidence or was
total
or was
coincidence?
That,
yeah. Was no, that... no, no, total coincidence. Total coincidence. No, there's some bad blood there. I've never in my life spoken to the man. So that was my last day. And then, Lee left Rockstar about a few weeks after I left 2K. He saw how calm and relaxed I was and got really jealous. And so he decided he would leave too. And then we started, I feel really bad to this day because when I said I was going to leave, one of the first things that happened was Sam Houser sent me a kind of a terse email saying, does this mean Lee is going too? Because, you know, Lee was still on the Rockstar. I said, absolutely not. This is just me. And then literally like 3 weeks later, Lee quit. So I look like an asshole. But it wasn't planned. It totally wasn't planned.
Can you describe the connection? Can you describe the connection between who Lee and Sam Houser are?
Oh, yeah. So Sam Houser started Rockstar Games many, many years ago. My history with Rockstar goes to before that when it was BMG Interactive. And I was working, so Ryan Brandt started Take-Two. Ryan passed away, you probably know. He founded Take-Two. I was doing some deals with him. And I was working with BMG Interactive, and I made the connection between them. And at the time, Take-Two was, you know, nothing, as you probably remember back then, Alex, right? It was like $7 a share or something like that, doing FMV games primarily.
Yeah, there was mostly distributing games, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And so Ryan heard that a company called American Softworks was going to buy BMG Interactive, and he wanted to talk to them. So he had, I said, go for it, but I think the deal is going to happen. And in any case, Ryan was like the best deal maker I think I've ever worked with or probably ever will work with. And he convinced BMG to sell to him instead. And that's how Rockstar Games came to be, run by, you know, Sam and his brother and others. And years later, I joined, maybe about 3 years later, I guess it was 2002, and on the Rockstar side. And my husband, Lee Cummings, was in QA at Sony. So he came with me and he ended up joining Rockstar, worked his way up to producing on Vice City and designing on Bully while I was starting 2K. So we kind of, and Take Two was very compartmentalized and things. So, you know, there were these divisions. And so I had Sam's blessing when we were setting up 2K. But then when I left, it was, you know, there was writing on the wall that maybe Lee would go too, and it really wasn't planned. And so I've always felt a bit bad about that.
I didn't know that. So did you actually introduce Ryan Brandt to Sam Houser?
I did, yeah. So I was a recruiter when I first got into the game industry, and I was working with the US part of BMG Interactive.
Hey, our first recruiter.
I started as a headhunter, and I was working with, so this was like Mike Suarez and Don Traeger and these guys, those guys, XEA guys in California. And they introduced me to the UK group because they were shutting down the US part of BMG, which was doing things like Spec Ops God, I don't even remember what else they were doing, a soccer game. Anyway, they decided they wanted to get out of the US market and sell off the distribution rights. And then the European part of BMG Interactive, which was doing Grand Theft Auto, for example, was going to stay in and try to get acquired. And so that's when I started working with them. And it was a Christmas that the N64 did really well, N64 games. So Ryan was interested at first because they had some N64 games to sell off rights to. But then it turned out that they were selling off the group, and that's where he asked for the introduction. And yeah, I didn't do the deal or anything, but I was pretty early in my career, but I helped to, I guess, connect the dots there.
It's a very interesting turn of events for the industry, right? Because Grand Theft Auto hadn't really blown up yet, and Take Two getting Grand Theft Auto has turned into the biggest game franchise of all time.
So what was it, like number two at that time?
It must have been GTA 2. Was it? Yeah. Was it the still top down?
Yes. GTA 2. No. It was GTA 1. I'm sorry. It was still GTA 1 because at the time, American Softworks, I don't know if you remember a company called American Softworks, Dave Klein, Steve Grossman in Connecticut. And that's where some of the Rockstar folks came from. They were going to acquire BMG Interactive. It could have all gone very differently. And that there was a deal in the works there for them to acquire it. In the end, Ryan did his thing, swooped it out, and I think he left them with the PC rights. And then Take-Two took over the PlayStation rights, you know, which was the bigger SKU anyway. I think I have that right. And so that was GTA 1. Then they did GTA 2 and some ill-fated things like surfing H3O and stuff like that back then. And then GTA 3 came out in 2001, right before I joined, right? But I flew out there Thanksgiving time, 2001, and it had just shipped, you know, right alongside September 11th. You know, that was right in the midst of it, of the first launch.
That was right when Halo was coming out.
I was going to say, yeah, that must have been right around the time you crossed paths, right?
Yeah. Well, so I got introduced to Ryan when through Jamie Lease, who I'm imagining you must have worked very closely with Jamie.
Yes.
Because we did a distribution deal with Ryan back in 99.
Yes.
So it's I don't know how many people know this story, but Take-Two had the distribution rights for Halo, and part of the deal that we did with Microsoft was acquiring those rights back. So could have been a different interesting turn of events.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I believe that saved Take-Two at the time, though, right, Alex? Like,
I do know that the cash that changed hands there was material for Ryan. So.
There you go. Yeah.
Where did you grow up? Did you grow up on the East Coast, or where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pennsylvania, and then I went to
whereabouts?
In Montgomery County, near Philadelphia, yeah. And then I went to college in Boston. I went to Brandeis. And then from there, I pretty much started.
Okay.
I moved from Boston to San Francisco, to New York, to LA, to the UK. It's kind of been the zigzag of my career.
It's like a accent tour. Like every place you just mentioned has like a unique accent, the speaking accent.
I'm getting a East Coast accent.
New York, Boston, Philly.
A little in between New York and Boston. I don't know what that accent is. How would you describe your accent, Susan?
A little bit of that. You know, it's funny. I've been married to a Brit for 26 years nearly. And so when I go to America, I've been asked if I'm British. And in the UK, they clearly know that I'm not British and American. So it kind of, and I have a very weird habit of affecting other people's accents. And so if I'm around someone too long, I'll start to pick up their accent. I've done that a bunch of times over the years. I spent a summer in Germany with a bunch of Irish people. I had an Irish accent by the end of the summer. It was pretty funny.
That's awesome.
Didn't last, but for like a couple weeks.
Yeah, getting to know people and making friends and fitting in is, you know, you should kind of share common behavior sometime. But all right, so you grew up in Pennsylvania, and were video games on the radar for you? Did you grow up playing games? Did you have any idea like what the game industry, I guess, you know, was, yeah, was there the much from there? Your perspective back then? Yeah, where did it start? How did things start?
I played a lot of television when I was a kid. My brothers were really into their sports games. To date myself, like we never had Atari systems, but we had an Intellivision. And one of the great like joys of my career, Utopia is like my first memory as a video game. And then of course I went on to get to know Don Daglow, and I saw him last year, and it's really cool to meet, like, you know, to meet your heroes. And so that was the first was Intellivision. You know, I played some Mac games in college. I grew up around the arcades as well. My mom had a gift shop, and so I played a lot of like Donkey Kong and Pac-Man and, you know, et cetera, back in the days in the arcades. It wasn't what I expected my career to be honest. I want to say I stumbled in by accident and then got hooked and never left. I was, like I said, I was a recruiter, and I went to a really good search firm that, now this would have been 1995, perhaps. When we still talked about multimedia as being what games are. And I remember vividly him saying to me, you need to specialize in something. And he threw this book of multimedia companies at me. And most of them were game companies. And so I just quickly became enamored with all the people I was meeting in video games. And that was the sort of accidental stumble into the industry. And I've always liked to work out of my depth. You know, I have imposter syndrome, but I've always like kind of harness that imposter syndrome and just to always push myself to for the next thing and the next thing. And so that's kind of my career has always been about challenging myself with something I haven't done before and figuring it out.
What makes you do that? Is that like a, is that the way you challenge yourself, or do you look at other people that are doing things that go, I could do that? Or like what, because we talk about this a bunch, you know, we had Mike Wilson on, you probably know Mike.
Yeah.
And he talks about his early days at it just feeling way out of depth. What motivates you to sort of like work out of your own depth?
Yeah, I think it's changed a bunch of times over the years. When I was young in my career, I'd say, you know, I was focused purely on deals for a really long time. Even through most of my time at Take-Two, every time I tried to get more focused on product, I'd get pushed back into focusing on deals. You know, I was reasonably good at doing that. But I always wanted to be closer to product. And so that definitely formed the second half of my career, I guess you'd say. But the first half was always about the deal and that, you know, that dopamine that you get from trying to get it done. And when I got the deal done, I'd get depressed because there was nothing to stress about. And so I went from doing small recruiting deals to doing these bigger licensing deals to going to Take-Two and doing these massive publishing deals that I had to have my neck on the line that, you know, that it was going to work. And so that's what drove me for a long time was, you know, sort of bigger and bigger, I guess, dopamine rushes of doing these big deals and progressing. The second half of my career, I'd say a lot of it has been about product. And, you know, when we left Take-Two, Lee and I, we started another company with Ryan, but suffice to say, eventually it ended up just being the two of us. And it was for like the next 10 years, it was just Lee and I doing the things that we wanted to do. And my biggest motivation was he had really cool ideas and I was going to figure out how to get them done and not disappoint him. And so a lot of my motivation was just figuring out how we could make our crazy ideas work and how we could, you know, continue to push ourselves forward and make things happen. When we set up over here in the UK, we were still two people up until 2 years ago, and now we're 26 people. And so what drives me now is the fact that I have a team that I really love. You know, I spent a whole career wanting a studio, and Lee was like, do we really want to have, you know, what we're all finding out now in the midst of layoffs, do we really want mouths to feed? Do we really want to have to look at people and eventually perhaps tell them they're losing their job or, you know, whatever, all the awful stuff that comes with it. But the good stuff that comes with it, of having it, a team that works together and cares and respects each other. That's what really drives me now. Like what gets me out of bed every day is making sure that I can secure their future. You know, I feel a bit like a mom in the company. And so that's what's motivating me now is how do we do more? How do we survive? How do we grow? And how do we do cool shit that people really like?
Yeah, that's I can relate to both of those things. They're very different. You know, it's like I'd love to talk a little bit more about, especially the deal making stuff. I have always had to do both. You know, I've had to build, you know, on the company side, but deal make, you know, do close, you know. And it is fascinating to me. I meet a lot of people who are in business or want to be in business. And from my perspective, there's such a high value on being able to close a deal. It's very easy to open a deal, and it's a lot harder to close a deal. And you seem to have an exceptional track record of getting deals closed. How do you approach that? And does that question make sense to you? Like anybody can talk, but to actually convince, you know, to get to a finish line where everybody's in agreement and is willing to invest in each other and the deal actually gets closed is hard. How do you approach that?
Well, part of it is just an almost blind willingness to believe you can pull it off. And no matter how audacious, you know, it sounds. And, you know, I guess a good example is I was able to do business deals, but for a long time, I couldn't close a VC deal. You know, we tried off and on a few times, and it was always, yeah, it used to be harder, right? Like VCs didn't care about games. And so it was really hard to try to close VC money, like going back 10 years. It was like it's understandable that I couldn't do it. And then back at the end of 2021, when we set out to raise, and it was Ed Fries who really kicked me in the ass and was just like, there's so much money out there and you have really good plans and you should just go for it. And I think I kind of just needed to hear someone tell me that I could do that, because I kind of was really hard on myself about that kind of deal that I just didn't know how to do it. And, you know, in the end, I had to have 26 people sign my shareholders agreement. And we were a small company, you know, and I was trying to protect my partner because I wanted him to focus on creative. And so, you know, I'd drag him into VC calls and, you know, 9 times out of 10, it goes to nothing. 9.9 times out of 10, it goes to nothing. And no matter how well you think it went, they pass. And I had to take that all on the chin, you know, and not talk about it any more than I had to. So he had no idea how many people we thought really liked us said no to us. And so that was like a weird, kind of lonely experience, just in purely self-driven. I'm a bit of a masochist, and I'm just like, I'm not going to tell you, just you focus, let me do this pain. And but I was convinced we could get it done, and you just don't stop. And I think I've always sort of been like that. I'll work 20 hours a day if I have to just get it done somehow. And it's also all about survival. You know, I think it's survival. I think it's very easy if you're in a really easy situation. You raise a couple $100 million, you know, it's, I don't think you have the hunger to get the things done. But when you know that if you don't get these deals done, everything falls apart. Because, you know, like you, Alex, I don't have the luxury to have someone else do the deals for me. You know, I'm having to, you know, run the company and make sure that, you know, everything keeps moving ahead. And I think that that's probably a good thing though, in some ways, you know, it means that it's that drive, you know, that it's like a do or die thing. Sometimes that's good.
It's part of it's persistence and it's,
yes.
Yeah.
But it's hard when it doesn't work. And especially it's hard to not take it personally when someone says no to you. I think that's what gets in the way for people. It's very hard not to take it personally.
That's the reason I don't do it. I let Alex do it.
Susan, I think it's good for people to hear you say that, because I don't know how many people hear it that, yeah, but to get a yes, you're going to hear a lot of no's first. Even in situations where you think like, oh, it must have been really easy for that person. It's probably not, you know? I think that is a really big part of how you get deals done is being persistent, you know?
Yeah. And success breeds confidence, you know?
Do you have any funny stories from any of the deals that you've done? Like,
well, sure. I mean, Bioshock. Let's talk about Bioshock and the fact that nobody else would sign it. Like, I've got some wonderful stories about the TK deals. I mean, I knew Ken from, you know, when he was doing Freedom Force, you know, the superhero game that he did. And we met a bunch of times. He was doing some really, you know, down and dirty port work. I want to say for Crave. I mean, so he was not like in the best place at the time. And he put an announcement out on GameSpot about Bioshock. And I have to give Ryan credit. Ryan and I were saying, he's like, whatever happened about that Bioshock thing? I said, really? You're into it? Because I'm into the Bioshock. You into the Bioshock? And we called Ken, and we very quickly got a deal together. But meanwhile, I cannot tell you how many deal people I met over the years who were like, yeah, we were trying for Bioshock. You took that from us. I'm like, no, talk to Ken Levine. No one would fund him. And not only that, we only funded him for $4 million. It went way over this. In the end, that was a $4 million deal for Bioshock. He wanted like seven. It was four. So that was a story of Bioshock and how that came to be. And Borderlands was signed.
Wow. And it made like $2 billion.
Yeah, that's Ken Levine, Bioshock. That's it. There's been many Bioshock games. It was exceptionally successful.
Right. And if you want to know why I signed it, well, we bought the studio in the end, because I'm long since NDA'd. We bought the studio in the end because at E3 that year, this would be E3 2004, I want to say, I think was the year we signed 2K. We started 2K. We had a deal that, you know, if someone tried to acquire the studio, we had a negotiation option. And so here we are at Take-Two having our big coming out party for 2K. And I get a text from Ken or a phone call to say someone's made a bid to buy the studio. And I remember Ryan and David Ismeller and Christoph and I were gathered around one of those stupid loud booths at E3 with a phone call with Ken in Boston. We're trying to work out a deal. Because at the time, not only that, we had XCOM tied up with them too. So we're like, this is not what we wanted to hear. So it cost a lot more than that because we ended up buying the studio before Bioshock came out. But the reason I signed it, and the reason we signed most of the things that we did back then, was instinctual largely. And in this case, it was because I thought Ken has been waiting for years to make the follow-on to System Shock. There's no way he's going to screw that up. If we give him the money that he needs and the time that he needs, he's going to do right by this. And I had no doubt in my mind that's the kind of game you sign. And that was really it. That was down to that. It wasn't down to P&Ls or anything else. Because, God, if you looked at a P&L for System Shock, the numbers weren't great. It was really down to the belief that Ken wouldn't let us down because we were going to empower him to make it. Borderlands, on the other hand, was a verbal pitch at E3 that same year. They had just done Brother in Arms was doing really well for them. And we pitched, we wanted to work with them. And so Matt, who was the designer, pitched us on two games. He pitched us on Borderlands and he pitched us on a Lethal Weapon buddy style shooter. And we picked Borderlands and signed basically on the back of that verbal pitch. At
good pick. Was there a reason, like you were talking about with Ken, where it's like you knew he was all in on this and this was like, this mattered to him and you knew he was going to do right by it? Did you see something, you know, that made you think Borderlands was going to be special, like at the time?
Yeah. I mean, Matt was great. I was very sold on Matt as a designer. The pitch was essentially, a Halo RPG, you know, it was Diablo with guns, you know, that was the original pitch for Borderlands. Now, it wasn't exactly what we signed, I will say. At the end of the vertical slice, there was that, do you remember that beautiful fight in Borderlands with that monster with like birds coming off of it or something like that? It's been so long since I played it. the game was going to be full of those. And we only ended up with that one, the vertical slice one. So that bothered me. I think it took a while to come into its own. I think that the first Borderlands was probably the weakest Borderlands. And subsequent Borderlands were much, much stronger. But yeah, we were once again, it was, you know, convinced on a creative vision. And, you know, in that case, it was his.
Last sort of question for me, at least. Aaron, I don't know if you have questions about this era, but that era where you're in New York at Rockstar and you're doing the business party, the business chapter of your career, what was the vibe like? And because I'd come out to New York a few times to meet with Ryan Brandt, who was CEO, founder of Take-Two. And I got to meet Sam Houser when we were doing Oni.
I remember Oni.
I remember a little bit about the vibe, but you know, I wasn't really in that office much at all. I visited a couple times. What was the vibe like?
Rough, really rough. It was a very, very difficult place to work in those days. You know, in some ways, it's interesting. I'm of a few minds on this. In some ways, really wonderful things came out of it. You know, which is wrong. You know, and it sucks because it was constant crunch. It was, you know, 7 days a week. You were there Saturdays and Sundays just to show face, if nothing else. Whether or not you had anything to do, you went in because that's what was expected of you. And that's all horrible. Great things came out of it, you know, out of that passion. So I have to give a little bit of credit to that. But it was at the expense of everyone's lives. You know, my husband largely missed my 30th birthday. He came for the last 2 minutes as, you know, as the clock was hitting midnight at a bar. And then he went back to working on, you know, Vice City, I think, at the time. So it was, you know, it was a very, not a toxic culture in other ways, in the ways you see of like what's happened at Blizzard. There was no harassment in that case. It was just a very bullying culture. And it was very, everyone bullied each other. You know, it was just, you just constantly had to be there. And that was hard. It was really, really hard. It wasn't great for us psychologically, I think, working there.
And now a word from our sponsors. Do you want your game to live forever? To supercharge it with immense powers of endless content, a buzzing gamer community, immortality, and coin? CurseForge 4 Studios, an exclusive service for visionary game developers, allows you to add safe, cross-platform mods to your game and enjoy all the benefits of user-generated content without any of the risks. With CurseForge for Studios, you can harness the creativity of our 165,000 devoted creators and the traffic of 43 million monthly gamers. You can also level up with premium mods and grant your game new revenue streams. Trusted by AAA Studios, CurseForge for Studios is an immortality potion for your game. Enter studios.curseforge.com and join the UGC era.
Leveling up your game dev career but not sure where to start?
Maybe you're trying to break into the industry, looking to connect with other people who are making games.
Consider joining the International Game Developers Association, the IGDA, the world's largest nonprofit, member-driven professional association serving all individuals who create games.
I was in the IGDA in Chicago, met a lot of people, great way to network.
The IGDA exists to support and empower game developers around the world in achieving fulfilling and sustainable careers.
Discounts,
educational and advocacy-based resources,
mentorship,
and solidarity across 160-plus chapters.
To join the IGDA, visit igda.org/membership and use the code IGDA4thCurtain15, no spaces there,
to get 15% off 1 and 2 year memberships, as well as a student membership.
Joining the IGDA is a great move for your career, and as a nonprofit supporting everyone making games, it's a great move for the whole community. Join today. All right, well, let's talk about keyboards. You know, I love a good mechanical keyboard. I got a chance to go
well,
over
hold on,
meet
no,
the guys
no, 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 stop, stop, stop. You were going to send me
what
you said. You were going to send me. That's how the conversation started. You thought,
listen, if you want to get yourself a keyboard,
you could win one, right?
Yeah, you should be following the Fourth Curtain. You should be on our Discord because we're giving away a High Ground high performance keyboard. These things are fantastic. Go visit highground.co. Check out what they've got going on over there. In fact,
and they sell
out. Discount code for you. They do these drops They sell out. They do have a section on their site for always available, and those are super cool too. Fourth Curtain 10, that's the code, gets you 10% off over at High Ground. They handed it to me, this keyboard, and I almost dropped it because it's so solid.
It's so heavy.
Yeah. Awesome. They're a great partner. Go head over to their website, use the discount code to get a 10% off. And we're giving one away too, so follow our Twitter at Fourth Curtain for details on how to win yourself a High Ground keyboard.
And now back to the show. During that era, I was going to ask you, I remember it being a big deal with every game had to have multiplayer. Like that was like the one of the check boxes. Is that something that was on, like when y'all were doing the like the pitches and stuff, was that like a bullet point? Like, oh, and the game is going to have PvP.
On the Rockstar side, no, for sure. Like Take-Two was terrible at multiplayer back then. You know, like there were a million different things about GTA Online that never happened and never happened. And so Rockstar was very single player focused, really, in my mind. I wouldn't say so. Like when we set up 2K, it was the exact opposite of Rockstar in the sense that Rockstar was very driven by creatively what Sam wanted to do. And he had a bunch of ideas that he wanted to, you know, franchises. And that's why they do so few things, because they were always things that mattered. There's Grand Theft Auto, you know, then there was Manhunt. Bully was because he and Terry had grown up playing School Days. So they had these things that they wanted to do. And that's why it makes so much sense that they acquire studios, because you need a, you know, it's the assembly of the vision, right? And it 2K, on the other hand, we didn't have that. We had a bunch of money. And, you know, Take-Two was getting hounded for not expanding beyond Grand Theft Auto and not putting enough product out. And so, you know, I think we had like a budget of a couple hundred million dollars to go out and sign. And the first thing I had to do was apologize to a lot of developers, because we had a terrible reputation for how we treated game developers. And then reach out to people and say, look, we have funding. We're willing to do a fair deal with you. We're willing to share the IP with you. Tell us what your brilliant ideas are, and so we can do stuff together, which was super fun. Like that was the most fun I probably ever had, was be able to go out there with a checkbook and say, "What do you want to do?"
You know? I can only imagine.
That is fun, right?
I like your shoes.
And look what came out of it. You know what comes out of that sort of mentality is BioShock and Borderlands. We bought Civilization. We bought XCOM. Actually, we got XCOM for free. We got it as a freebie thrown in with Civilization. You know, we got the distribution rights to Oblivion. Like so many good things. 2K Sports. We bought 2K Sports. So many great things came out of just having a tranche of money to say, okay, what do you want to do? But it was never really multiplayer in my memory of it anyway. It was really more strong, original creative visions. Like we didn't like licensed IP very much. You know, we bought TDK. Back then, and that was a disaster. Like we just hated licensed IP at Take-Two. Back then, I'm sure it's changed since then. But
so it sounds like between Take-Two and Rockstar, some similarities on the, you know, creativity side, but also sounds very different. Where on the Rockstar side, you had Sam driving this creative centrally and hiring studios to execute, whereas what you were building was basically relationships with teams that you could invest in their vision. Is that sort of fair to describe how the two brands operated differently?
100%, yeah.
Fascinating. Okay, well, so you do leave and you head west and you end up in California.
Yeah, so we set up Tiny Rebel after my son was born. We took some time off and then we started consulting. And we took on a big project with Paramount. They moved us out to California to run the games group and to do some products there. That's how we ended up in LA. The thing is, once we left Paramount, we just lingered, you know, and we started working in mobile. We did our Doctor Who game, and we weren't near family, and our kid was 7. And that was what led us to the decision to move out to the UK. To be closer to family.
Okay, so LA was kind of like a pit stop for you. It was a little bit of...
It was a long pit stop.
The non-compete's going to lapse.
It was fun. It was where I got more interested in in IP, you know, in licenses. We were so against it at Take-Two. This was kind of my journey into licensed IP to find out all the horrible things about it and potentially all the good things about it. And so we spent about a year and a half on the Paramount lot. And we worked on the Star Trek game that Digital Extremes was working on, which won a lot of awards until they gutted the games group at Paramount. And then it went downhill very quickly. That's around the time we left Paramount. But it was fun while it lasted, working with Bad Robot and others on what could have been a really wonderful game, but unfortunately wasn't. Mm. It's what led to Warframe. You know, that's that whole, that engine like went on to become that instead.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And then we did a game with Patrick Stewart. We did a War of the Worlds recreation, which my partner had wanted to do forever. So we did a very Limbo style Xbox game that was a tribute to War of the Worlds. It was one of the cooler things we ever did that got no marketing, but it was still one of my favorite games I've worked on with Other Ocean, with Mike Mica.
And Patrick Stewart was did voiceover for it?
I convinced Patrick Stewart to do this, to voiceover the whole track. It's hours of Patrick Stewart talking. And I think he did it for $25,000. His agent like laughed at me when I offered this deal because we had no budget, even though we were Paramount. And he said, there's no way he's going to do that. But this is a wonderful story. He comes back the next day, like tail between his legs, and says, turns out Patrick, you know, is happy to do it for that amount of money, because as a child, he and I guess his brother would run around quoting War of the Worlds, you know, in the old film. And so there was nothing he would love more than to be involved in a project related to War of the Worlds. So I got to sit in a sound studio with Patrick for 2 days in London, which will forever be a high point of my career.
Yeah, that's awesome. Matt Booty told us that, when he was doing the Star Trek pinball game, similarly, they wanted Patrick Stewart to do voiceover and they couldn't afford it. But turns out he was a big pinball game fan and was willing to do it. So
that's amazing. I guess so. If you find the right thing.
Or maybe he's just a super chill guy.
Oh, he was. He absolutely was. He's his own worst critic. It was really funny listening to him. There was this moment where my voice director, Naveed Kansari, who worked for Rockstar for many years, did a great job voice editing him. But I remember this one moment where you hear Patrick saying, come on, Patrick, you can do better than that. I'm going to go again. And so he was obsessive. Like it was just, it was like watching him, you know, watching him act for 2 days. I mean, how much more could you ask for, really?
That's awesome. Okay, cool. And you got to work on you actually set up an office on the Paramount studio lot?
Yeah, technically we'd gone to work for them on staff, but the guy who was running the group didn't tell Paramount that.
Okay.
And so so we ended up being very highly paid consultants for 2 years. That's a whole other story. I got lots of stories after 26 years.
Is Petaverse now, like, is that only mobile? Sorry, we're jumping ahead. I don't know if y'all want to skip ahead. I wanted to know if
we should jump ahead. I mean, so when did you start working on Petaverse, and actually we didn't talk about the brewery. Like, when did those things kick off?
My brother-in-law started the brewery, Lee's kid brother. They started that about 10 years ago, I think it was, using our name. And they've been tremendously successful and a walking distance from our house. I'm not saying that's why we moved to the UK, but the fact that a brewery is walking distance from the house is cool. we started working on this years ago. We won a big government grant in the UK. We won a £5 million grant, not all for us, but for a few companies, to work on some experiments in AR with Wallace and Gromit. So, ooh. Which got us involved with Aardman, who are like part of our family.
That's amazing.
And It was amazing. So we got to play on like the bleeding edge of AR on government funding. Didn't have to be commercial, and so that was great. And on the back of that, this project started life in AR. It's not an AR project, but that was what got us excited. Was knowing what was possible with spatial computing and LiDAR got me interested in something more approachable than reinventing storytelling like we were trying to do with this project. Instead, I said to Lee, you know, could we get a virtual pet up and running in a space but be able to do more than just AR with it? How do we make that interoperable with other experiences? And so Petaverse is really about treating the pet as a discrete thing, you know, with an animation system behind it that we can then create lots of games for. And so that's what we built over the last 3 years, is an interoperable pet.
Oh, it's like a metaverse type thing.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, It's not a Web3 project. We dabbled with Web3. Maybe eventually we'll come back to dabbling with Web3. In the end, we found most people were just too untrusting of what your intentions might be. And we always had good intentions. I said, wouldn't it be amazing if you could have a character as a sidekick and know you could always have it and that I couldn't take it away from you by shutting down the game? And so that was what got us excited about, you know, about things like blockchain. But so what we did is we've created a Tamagotchi, you know, Nintendogs game. But all the mini games you get to play your pet in within that game and collect things for. But you can also bring them onto your video call, and you can bring them onto your Twitch stream and let your friends play with your pet on camera. And you can bring them into AR, and you can bring them into wearable glasses, AR. You can bring them into VR. But it's all the same sort of pet in a cloud that has all these, has its memories. Yeah. And then we've also, to make it a more compelling experience, we've built a simulation of the life for this pet, so that when you're not with them, they're making decisions. And we built this on top of ChatGPT, so we can actually simulate a diary for your virtual so they can make decisions about where to go and even send you things, little mementos of where they've been. And their stats, their sort of Tamagotchi stats, are impacted by the decisions that they've made. So if they get beaten up by another cat, they might need care, you know, for example. Or if they've been on a long journey, they might need food or what have you. But you can see how their stats change based on the things that they're doing. So essentially, we built an end-to-end, you know, pet solution.
They might find some treasure when they go off on their adventure too.
Exactly. Yeah. And send it to you.
Do the cats ever show up with like a dead bird or a mouse and just like put it down on you, you know, on the counter? That's what my cat does. It goes on little adventures and comes back with a dead bird. It's like, whoa, Snowball.
I love the idea of it. There's no reason they can't, because they can send you paints from the, like if they go to another city, they can send you stickers. They can send you a gift. And there's no reason we couldn't have them send you a dead bird as an accessory. It's a cute idea.
This sounds super cool. So the pet, there's, just so I understand how this actually works, the pet lives, or it is extant on a server, right? And you allow me to interact with it on any, like as on as many platforms as you can implement a client for, basically. Is that, so it's like I can do things in Meta, or I could do things on the web or on my phone or in Zoom or whatever. Is that sort of how
that's it works? Exactly right.
From a
that's
technical exactly right. standpoint.
Yeah.
Is anybody else doing something like that?
Not that I know of. I mean, Ready Player Me is doing avatars, you know, people to be and to be brought between games. They're not building games themselves, but to be brought between platforms. We've also built a web trading platform, like what kids are doing in Roblox, so that you could come in and you could trade accessories on a web version now of your pet. And you can trade in real time with other players and stuff. So again, leaning into all the, I imagine, smartwatches in the future. You know, we've got a lot of things we've wanted to do that we haven't done yet. But I also want to let developers have access to it as well. Because if you're building in Unity and you want a pet animation system, why not just use ours? And that means, you know, via our backend, you could take care of your pet in someone else's game. If our backend knows that you took that pet
that
into some other
awesome.
Game.
Huh.
Oh, their fun factor went up because they went into Roblox, you know, whatever the game happens to be. That's where we really are going with it, is as a platform, letting other people use it.
Super cool.
Have you thought of doing the Petaverse? Like, is there any like talk of doing the Petaverse as like companionverse, like having like a sidekick that you could, you know, like, so it's not limited to pets, or are y'all going to stay in the animal?
No, No, absolutely. In many ways, Pediverse feels like it was a limiting name that we started using. We have, we're doing a license, I can't announce it yet, with a brand where they definitely do not feel like pets. And so, it, you know, we're going to have to deal with the naming at that point.
Awesome.
And I've always imagined that you could have a robot, you could have a dinosaur, you know, you could have an alien. It could be another person, you know?
Yeah.
So absolutely, it could work for anything.
Yeah. There's so many cool. My mind is like, you could.
I was just going to add another really important thing about this is we've made it so that the art style can be changed. Because, you know, as developers, you know, we don't want someone else to dictate an art style for us. So we have a text description of each of these pets that describes their model, their blend shapes, their textures, et cetera, so that you could put them in a different art style. And we've already do that. Like, we have one art style in an AR app that's completely different from the main game just because of what's performance, you know, on that device. So they're art agnostic, really. You could use our art if you want, but you could actually reimagine their art style for a different game.
So there's like a language that describes the pet that can be used to drive how they're visually represented. Yeah, that's very smart. So you started the studio up after you left Take-Two, but now you've kind of, it sounds like you have found your calling and you're building it's a product, it's a tech. I don't know if you're monetizing yet or not, but how is it different for you? Like, your first half of your career, like you were describing, your career's had two halves. How's it different from you now running a studio with 26 employees and, you know, doing the fundraising and having a product? And I don't know what your long-term vision is, if this is something that you're going to, you know, pass to your kids, or if you're going to sell it, or if it's just you're just thinking about making money off this product or what. Like, how's your life changed, and how are those two parts of your career different? Like, how's it different now for you?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I've more than ever, I value hiring people who are better than me at things. Like, I think a really important skill in good management is being willing to hire people who know more than you do about certain things, because you can't, you know everything. And so, so I'm surrounded with people who are really good at areas that maybe I'm not. And, you know, and I've had to learn to delegate more and more, and find people that I can trust to delegate more and more. Because I don't have time to do the things that I did 2 years ago. I don't have time to do payroll like I did 2 years ago. Now, you know, my COO and my bookkeeper handle that stuff, and I have very little to do with it. And that was a big mental step for me, being able to do that. And so that's really important. I mean, you know, it's hard being a startup. You know, you're constantly having to think about your runway, and you're constantly having to think about expenses, and you're constantly having to think about what the future looks like and project and talk to your investors. And so, you know, so my job has definitely changed, and I have to be the motivator in a way that I haven't had to be before. You know, we're fully remote, but, you know, we get together every 3 months. And so you have to stand in front of 26 people and explain, you know, talk about why the future is bright, but also be willing to talk about the things that you don't do well, and, you know, and really have a culture where people feel that they can be comfortable coming forward and, you know, saying they're not happy about certain things. So, you know, and I think that the generation that's growing up now have big expectations of the workplace that we were happy to have, you know, about the life at Rockstar would not exist now. Like, the millennial generation would never go for that, and good, they shouldn't. And so I think that expectations of management have really risen over the years of what you expect from your boss. And so, you know, we're held to a really high standard, and, but that's good. That's good. You know, we need to improve it and grow up as an industry. So that all has definitely changed over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. You said a couple things in there. I wanted to ask you about, like, hiring people that are better at stuff than you are. I think that's a thing that's, I think it's easier to say than to do, you know, because there's ego involved. There's sort of like understanding what, you know, you could use help with. Like, tell me how you do that.
it's a trust thing. Yeah. My COO, we hired him on our grant project, and this is like his last hurrah before retirement. And I keep him from retirement. I keep, convincing him to stay on. But he's great. He's a friend. And what I've learned is that the CEO gets to stress and the COO doesn't get to stress as much. And they're the ones who tell you why everything's going to be okay. Only so many people can think the house is burning down at the same time. And so I can enjoy the fact that I get to be the one who thinks the house is burning down and he tells me why it's not. And so I think it's very easy when you're used to being a small company, when I'm used to it being just the two of us with Lee and I, it's very easy for me to forget that I'm in it with a lot of people now. And I don't have to fix every single problem myself. And as soon as I started to realize that, that was really liberating. Not in a way that I'm like passing the buck and saying, it's not my problem, you deal with it. It's just more, I can sit down with really smart people and have a conversation and say, what do we do about this? And so between my husband, who I obviously, we've worked together for 26 years now, I trust him on the creative side and I trust my COO and our CTO, I've known for nearly 26 years as well. So we're all really good friends, the four of us running the company. And that attracts those sorts of people too, in terms of who falls away and who sticks around. Like we've got a really loyal team. They're loyal to each other, loyal to me. And that, that makes it fun. But yeah, it is, you do have to be really objective to say, what aren't you good at? And sometimes Lee tells me what I'm not good at. It says to me, you need someone to help you with this. You can't handle all of this yourself. Sometimes I need to be told that, reminded that, I guess, that I can't do everything myself.
I think trust is a huge, you said trust there is a huge part of it is, like when you bring somebody in who's new, it sort of changes the dynamic of a team and you need to figure out how to build trust with your, especially 26 is in kind of, it's not tiny, but it's not super huge, right? So when you're bringing in somebody into a team like that, you need to figure out how to get the trust as quickly as possible. I find it's harder working remotely because you just get less examples or less interactions than when you're in an office. But it sounds like one thing that you've done is sought out people that you have experience with.
Yes. I was going to say, I think that there's a snowball effect there. I just did a talk at Pocket Gamer in London about remote work. I'm not a fan of hybrid working. I think it creates like a classist system of the people who can come in and the people who can't, And so I'm very purist about this. We are a remote company. We get together every few months.
Cool.
We do not maintain
a class system.
It does though, because I saw this on our collaboration project, that grant that we had. We had three companies working together and we all got together a few days a week, but there were people who couldn't. And so they were always a step removed from us. And so I kind of feel like you have to kind of go all or nothing one way or the other. And so that's why we've done it this way. And it is hard, but there's a snowball effect in having a core of people who really clearly like and trust each other. And I think it inspires that in other people. And the people who aren't a part of that, very quickly becomes, look, it's hard to hire. I'm terrible at identifying out of an interview what I want. It's why we have the 3-month probation, so we can figure out if they really are, the right fit. But these things kind of work themselves out for themselves. It's very rare that I feel like we've badly hired, but it's usually pretty clear to them too, that they're not a fit. Not that they're a bad person, just that, for whatever reason, it's not a fit. And I think part of that is having a core that you trust. I think that we were lucky that we hired out of a project that we had just worked on. So we were, and a management team that knows each other. So we were in a position that we could set up a company culture that way. Whereas if you started from scratch, if you just went out there with, two people and raised money and had to build with all strangers, I think that'd be really hard. I don't know how well that can be done.
And it sounds like you do this three month. Is it like when you hire somebody, is that the deal? It's like, hey, we're going to hire you and the first 90 days, we'll have a check-in and at the end of that, it'll become more permanent or you're out? How do you do that?
Part of it is the UK, it's the differences in employment law between the UK and the US. So you have to, once someone's passed that period, it becomes very difficult. More difficult for them to go as opposed to America where you could just say, sorry, it didn't work. So I think there's a bit more, thoughtfulness maybe, or just a like, we need to make sure before we're in that realm. And so, you know, at the end of that 3-month period, that's where people get their stock options, and we give people a stipend to help with their costs, because we don't have an office space. So we help people with, you know, their phone costs and internet costs and things like that. So we have this little trial period for them too. You know, the notice periods change at the end of that. So I think it's more common over here than it was in the US. And I think it's because of the protections that exist over here for employment after that sort of probation period.
What do you look for to the most, like on your day-to-day, when you're like getting up, getting ready to get to work? What part of the job gets you the most excited?
I really enjoy stand up in the morning. You know, we have, you know, a lot of rituals that we put in place, especially because of remote work. And so getting everyone on camera first thing in the morning is great. And it took a while to get that down to 20 minutes with like 26 people. But I really enjoy seeing the whole team together.
I can imagine.
You know? In the morning and hearing what everyone's up to. So that is something that I take really seriously and think is important. You know, I'm a sucker for builds too. You know, we're about to launch, so I'm always excited when new builds are coming through that I can play with things, you know, and see what everyone's been up to. But I would say it's probably those things. The rituals are good. You know, it makes it less lonely, the remote working thing, having good rituals.
Agreed. Do you put prep into, like, when you host a stand up, and I don't know if you say every week or every morning?
Every morning. So my producer kind of hosts it.
Every morning. Okay.
Yeah. And okay. I kick it off. I kick it off.
So for you, it's an opportunity to be present. Yeah. Okay. So it's an opportunity for you to give a little bit of motivation for the team, be present and be involved with the day-to-day of everybody on your staff. Yeah, I can see how that could be really super energizing.
And hear what everyone's put up to. And yeah. We added a 10-minute coffee before stand-up, which is like our water cooler moment. And it's just a place to just shoot the shit about like what the movie, you know, what movie you watched last night or wherever else. And it's optional, but it kind of gets the gabbing out of your system so that when we get to stand up, we can just talk about what everyone's actually up to that day, not what movie you saw last night. So that's been fun too. And it's nice to just go in and have a coffee and chat.
That's smart.
Awesome. All right, Susan, we've kept you over an hour. It's so great to see you. And congratulations on all the, on what you've been building. Did you say you have a release coming up?
We do, yeah. We are having our, we're starting our market test in the Philippines at the end of this week on the mobile game.
Well, congratulations on that. Thanks for hanging out with us. It was awesome to get to catch up. Here's some of the funny stories from the early days, and also the not so funny ones. Those were interesting. and we'll see you around.
Bye.
How cool to catch up with Susan. You've never met Susan before.
No, I've never met. I've played many of the games that she's worked on, though.
Yeah.
Many. I mean, it's like a lot.
Some crazy stories. Yeah, some crazy stories from the early Take-Two days and that kind of thing. We mentioned at the beginning that there were many sort of parts of this that we wanted to talk about.
Yes, I'm glad you said it. Bring it up. What is it? What is the one that you wanted to do?
Her career evolution, where it started, you know, she started in basically recruiting, you know, and it got good at doing at deal making, and was running, you know, a label, and now has her own studio. And when she talks about what motivates her at running her team, it was very relatable to me. You know, just the sense of obligation, responsibility, and pride in providing an environment of a, you know, with a particular culture, but an enduring and a safe one, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think she said in there, you know, that she would happily work 20-hour days to make sure that this company is successful and survives and thrives, because she loves it so much and she loves the people that she works with. Yeah. And I just found that to be very, very relatable. And we've heard that from so many folks who have their own studios before. And it does feel to me kind of like a thread from many of our episodes that, you know, at these smaller companies where everybody kind of knows each other, they were built by a founder operator. There's love and care for the people.
And the game.
I was going to say yes, and the game, but I think it's the people first, and then and then the game, with the knowledge that, hey, we're building this team because the team, if it's great, is going to make great games. Whereas at a larger company where it's less personal, you know, I think the equation is a little different. You know, they're building an engine of games, and the people are a means to the end, and the priorities are different. You know, it's not a judgment. It's just an observation from, you know, talking to folks that are running their own studios that, you know, the thing they're most proud of is providing that consistent, stable work environment.
Do you think if you made the game the priority that it would, and not the milestones, not meeting milestones, because I've worked at studios where the milestone was the flag, you know, that everyone was going to, and it did affect, like, when it's milestones, I saw it affect people a lot, because it didn't matter that it was a Saturday, you haven't seen your family. Do you think when the game, though, when, like, the people or the studio head cares about the game so much, do you think that's where it gets toxic, or does it?
You know, it really depends on the sort of the how. Yeah. But I think when you prioritize the health of the studio through the relationship you have with the individuals who make up that studio, that's a long-term view. And when you make decisions to maximize a particular project at the expense of the people, it's a short-term view.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I've actually encountered that because I came up in the industry when it was not mature yet. It was post the console collapse or whatever it's called, you know, the console wars. Like, it was the bad way that you were saying at almost every studio. This is pre and during the EA spouse thing. And I've noticed that coming out of that, like, even interacting with you, like, you know, because I've been an art director and stuff, and I've had, like, issues about something, and I've brought it up to you, and my response was, because of being trained that way, felt very, like, cutthroat at times, you know, like, very harsh. And I still have it a little bit, you know. That's why I don't like being a lead sometimes, because it's like, I haven't matured there, maybe. But I, like, I've talked to you, and you're like, okay, let's be cool about this, Aaron. And it's like, what are you talking about, man? We gotta freak out. We gotta throw this guy off the No, I'm just kidding. the plank, walk the plank. But you know what I mean? Like, so when you're in that environment, I think it programs you to think that way, you know? And I don't think it's good, especially like the shovelware, like when there was all that shovelware that was being made, like, we gotta make a game in a year. It doesn't matter. And it was just like, it's 7 days a week at the studio.
No, but I mean, back in the 90s, when a lot of these companies were starting and a lot of people were getting into this industry and building it for the first time, everybody was younger. And so, outlooks were different. You know, less mature. Yeah, had a lot of energy. I think you could convince yourself that you were prioritizing both, the team and the project. And I think in a lot of cases, that was the case. I mean, that's how I feel about the early Bungie days. Like, we worked a lot of hours. Yeah, we had those cots in the...
Yeah, Eddie talked about it some too, right? Like, Eddie brought it up when he was... Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, this was another thread that we've talked about, is that hard work sometimes is drive, sometimes it's crunch, and crunch is when it's sort of put upon you, and drive is when it's, you know, it's internally motivated. Does it make it okay? I don't know. You know, Tim Schafer drove himself through a divorce, and I think he decided it was not okay.
It's not okay. Yeah, you know, I agree.
In the early Lucas days. But it is interesting how the industry has matured that way, and how a lot of the successful independent studio operators have that same POV, that it's about the team. You know, this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. We can't burn out the team to make this one game. We have to figure out how to prioritize the health of the company, because that's the goose, you know, hopefully that's laying the golden eggs.
Yeah. I think it helps seeing it. And especially, I think in Texas, you could do this. You could just get fired. And I've seen it happen before. I'm going to tell you a story that is very scary. I worked at a studio, not going to say the name of the studio. There was a lot of cool people there, a lot of talent. And they were hiring game designers, and these game design, this is this isn't during the Xbox 360 era. So there's a lot of people trying to get into the industry at this time. The education system is starting to mature as well. So you're seeing a lot of people going to school to get these game design careers, you know? Yeah, like 2008-ish around there, right? I remember that we hired a bunch of these designers and they were getting paid peanuts, like barely able to survive. And one of the guys couldn't pay his bills. So he would work at the studio and then at night would go sack groceries. And this is like a grown man, you know, like he wanted to be a game designer so bad. He went to sack groceries. And the CEO ran into him at the grocery store and fired him because he broke the contract. What? Yeah. So it's like, it's one of those stories where I don't like.
Wouldn't it make more sense to give the guy a raise so he didn't have to work two jobs?
I don't know, but that was kind of the culture that was, you know, and, you know, maybe the guy was a jag and we don't know. That was just a good excuse to fire him. I didn't know the guy. Maybe he wasn't a good designer and they were trying to find a way to get rid of him. But just that, like...
That makes the story less interesting, though, Aaron, if you try to make excuses for
that. I'm trying to make... It's just that was the culture, though. It was very cutthroat. And it really gets into people. And I've worked with people that are leads now from that era. And they still... Like I was telling you, I still kind of have it sometimes.
It's right.
Like, and I'm like, get out of me. Get out of my body.
I do think that's a horrible example. I mean, it's a good example, but it's a horrible story, right? And yeah. I think a good thing about the maturation of this industry and the fact that it's gotten more successful and bigger is we do have some better ideas about how to take care of people.
And there's more games now, too. It's kind of cool.
hopefully we don't have that kind of experience again.
The industry has gotten more mature. And it's there's places to work that are you don't kill yourself doing it, and everyone as a collective is trying to get there, and you see that being reflected in the games that are being made, you know, and in the era we talked about, everything was like just killing. There was a lot of killing, you know, and it was like it was almost like a mirror image of the industry. And then now you see like Animal Crossing, and you know what I'm saying, like.
Or Cocoon.
Cocoon, yes.
One of our favorites lately.
Very good game.
Those guys are so cool.
Okay, that's all I wanted to say.
All right, well, thank you everybody for joining us again this week. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Susan. We sure did. And we shall see you again next time.
See you later, everybody. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Fourth Curtain Podcast. The Fourth Curtain is a production of Fourth Curtain Media with community management by Doug Zartman. Lovingly edited and mastered by Brian Hensley at Noise Floor Sound Solutions in Chicago. To get a peek at upcoming episodes or to send in questions to the show, visit our site at thefourthcurtain.com. And be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening.